2 Samuel chapters 21 and 22, the 12th talk in a series on 2 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on June 13, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 2 Samuel chapters 21 and 22. I'm going to be teaching this week and next week, and I'll be finishing up 2 Samuel these 2 weeks, and then Ron will be taking over after that. This section at the end of 2 Samuel is particularly intriguing. What makes it intriguing is trying to figure out why it's here and what is the author trying to say by putting it here. There's quite a bit of material, but I think that I will be able to leave time for questions at the end. So as we're going along, as you think of questions, please jot them down and let's talk about them afterwards. You may be able to come up with even more questions than I have. This section, the last 4 chapters of 2 Samuel, seems to be a break from what we've had before. Up until now, it's been a continuous historical narrative that has been organized, for the most part, chronologically. So why is chapter 13 after chapter 12? Because chapter 13 happened after chapter 12. That's typically the way that it has been done up to now. But these last 4 chapters appear to be a distinct break from that. There's something else going on. There is, as commentators have noticed, there's a change in the style of writing. There's a change in the vocabulary that is used. You'll notice that it's going to start with, now there was a famine in the days of David. Never before has any section started with something like that. Because you knew that all of it was in the times of David, because that's what we're talking about. So it appears to be a significant break from what we've had before, and it appears to be a coherent unit that is stuck at the end of 2 Samuel, and what I'm going to argue next week is I think that it summarizes 2 Samuel, and we'll talk about that more. Notice also that it is in a 1-2-3-3-2-1 pattern, in that it starts out with a natural catastrophe that's been sent by God, and it tells that story. Then it's going to tell us about a series of heroes of Israel who killed giants. And then it's going to give us a psalm of David. Then it's going to give us another psalm of David. Then it's going to list the mighty men of David and tell us a little bit about what they achieved. And then it's going to end with another natural catastrophe sent by God. So it's 1-2-3-3-2-1. So it all seems to fit together. There's an organizational pattern here that holds it all together. It's a coherent whole, and our task is to figure out what it's doing. Chapter 21, first 6 verses. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the presence of the Lord. And the Lord said, "It is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death." So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the sons of Israel, but of the remnants of the Amorites. And the sons of Israel made a covenant with them. But Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. Thus David said to the Gibeonites, "What should I do for you? And how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord?" Then the Gibeonites said to him, "We have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." And he said, "I will do for you whatever you say." So they said to the king, "The man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within any border of Israel, let 7 men from his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." And the king said, "I will give them." So a famine has come on Israel. Famine wasn't entirely unusual in Israel, but this one goes on for an extended period of time. It goes on for 3 years, and 3 years is a long time to endure a famine. And it's interesting that David waits. It's not until after the third year that we have any record of David appealing to the Lord, entering into his presence to determine what is the cause. But apparently, after 3 years, it's clear to David this is not an ordinary famine. There's something special going on here. And so inquiring of the Lord seems to be appropriate. So he sought the presence of the Lord, and God responds to him. So apparently what David is inquiring is, Why are we suffering this famine? And God's response is, "It is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death." All he says is, it's because of what Saul did to the Gibeonites. There is no place else in either First or Second Samuel that it talks about Saul conducting any kind of campaign against the Gibeonites. So this is the only place that we have mention of it. And we can only piece together what was happening, what Saul was up to, from the clues in the text here. But let's go back and refresh our memories as to what is happening with the Gibeonites. That is, who are they, and why would they be significant here? If you'll recall, when Joshua was leading the Israelites into the land of Canaan, they were going, according to the instructions of God, they were going from one city to the next, and they were destroying all of the inhabitants. That typically they were asked to kill every man, woman, and child, and even the animals in the cities that they conquered within the land of Canaan. Those were God's instructions. And they had entered into Canaan, first coming to Jericho, and Jericho was leveled, and the Israelites killed all of the people in Jericho, except for one. And then they moved on to other cities, and they did the same. So within Canaan, the people of Canaan are seeing this threat coming. They know that the Israelites are moving through, and they're taking the cities one after the other with great success, and clearly they are becoming fearful. And the people of Gibeon fit into that category. They see this coming, they know they're in trouble, And so they try to figure out what they're going to do in response to it. And we have an account of what they did in Joshua 9, verses 1 through 27. So I'll read that. Joshua 9, 1 through 27. "Now it came about, when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country, and all the lowland and all the coast of the great sea towards Lebanon, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard of it, they gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and Israel. When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins worn out and torn and mended and worn-out and patched sandals on their feet and worn-out clothes on themselves. And all the bread of their provision was dry and had become crumbled. And they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a far country. Now, therefore, make a covenant with us." And the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you are living within our land. How then shall we make a covenant with you?" But they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." Then Joshua said to them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" And they said to him, "Your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord your God. For we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, who is at Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey, and go to meet them, and say to them, "We are your servants. Now then, make a covenant with us." This, our bread, was warm when we took it for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But now, behold, it is dry and has become crumbled. And these wineskins, which were filled with new, and behold, they are torn. And these our clothes and our sandals are worn out because of the very long journey. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. And it came about at the end of 3 days after they had made a covenant with them that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. Then the sons of Israel set out and came to their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon, Kephirah, and Beeroth, and Kiriath-Jearim. And the sons of Israel did not strike them, because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders said to the whole congregation, "We have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we cannot touch them. This we will do to them, even let them live, lest wrath be upon us for the oath which we swore to them." And the leaders said to them, "Let them live." So they became hewers of wood and drawers of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken to them. Now I'll finish this chapter. Then Joshua called for them and spoke to them, saying, "Why have you deceived us, saying, 'We are very far from you,' when you are living within our land? Now therefore you are cursed, and you shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God." So they answered Joshua and said, "Because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you, therefore we feared greatly for our lives because of you and have done this thing. And now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us." Thus he did to them and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel, and they did not kill them. But Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord to this day in the place which he would choose. So what's happening here is, as the Israelites are coming into to Canaan and having all of these successes, the cities of Canaan have decided, we need to band together and form an alliance to fight against the Israelites. That's our only chance. And so they want all of the cities of Canaan to come together. And before the Israelites came, the cities of Canaan were not united. They just fought among themselves constantly. But now they need an alliance in order to defend themselves against the Israelites. So most of them have formed an alliance, but the people of Gibeon decide, no, we are not going to ally ourselves with these Canaanite cities. What we are going to do is perform a ruse. We're going to claim that we aren't from this area, and we are going to make a covenant with the people of Israel so that we will not be destroyed. So that's exactly what they do. They pretend that they have come from a distant land, that they aren't from Canaan at all, and they indicate that they're aware of where the Israelites have come from and what their history is and where they're going and what their destiny is. And they make a covenant with the Israelites. And they do so by deceiving them. And they outright lie to them, to the Israelites. But they make an agreement. Well, a little bit later, the Israelites realize what's happened. They come to understand that the Gibeonites are just a few tens of miles away. And the Israelites, some of the Israelites, want to kill the Gibeonites because they are Canaanites in the land. God had told the Israelites to kill the Canaanites in the land. But because they had made this covenant with Israel, Joshua wouldn't allow that to happen. And that does not happen. But the Gibeonites are made servants of the Israelites. They will chop wood and they'll carry water for the service in the temple. And those will be their duties from here on out. And it's interesting, the response of the Gibeonites when Joshua said, "Why did you do this?" It's because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you. Therefore, we feared greatly for our lives because of you and have done this thing. And now, behold, we are in your hands. Do as seems good and right in your sight to do to us. They believe the promises that God has made to Israel. That they believe that the Israelites are going to come in and be successful. And as a result, they want to be allied with the Israelites. And they say, do to us whatever seems right in your eyes. So it shows an incredible amount of trust on the part of the Gibeonites in the Israelites and the God of Israel. And I think that that is significant. I will not go on to read the rest of the account, but in chapter 10, the other cities of Canaan decide, well, if you Gibeonites are not going to join us, we're going to come and beat you up. And so they launch an attack against the Gibeonites, and the Gibeonites say, we're in trouble here. And they turn to the Israelites and say, we need help. And the Israelites say, we made an agreement with you. We're coming to your aid. And they do so, and they're able to turn back the attack of the Canaanites. Okay, so that's the history. That's who the Gibeonites are. Now, it would appear then that what's happened is Saul has decided that God told the Israelites, kill all of the Canaanites. And Saul is going to carry out that command. Saul apparently took it upon himself then to extend the ban, that is, extend that commandment that God had given to wipe out the Canaanites to the Gibeonites as well. And that's apparently why it says, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. So in his zeal for carrying out the commandment that God had given to the Israelites, Saul was going to wipe out the Gibeonites. And when it says he sought to kill them, the word that's used there is the word that's used in Joshua when God tells the Israelites to kill the Canaanites. It has religious connotations to that particular word. So that's apparently what Saul attempted to do. And apparently he was not successful in wiping them out, but in all likelihood he killed a number of them. God says that the reason for the famine is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death. So apparently there was a serious attempt on his part to wipe out the Gibeonites, but he was not entirely successful in doing so. So David then says, okay, given that that's the cause, that's the reason for the famine. God doesn't tell David, by the way, what he should do with respect to the famine. He just says that it's because of what Saul had done. So David goes to the Gibeonites and he says, what should I do? What needs to be done here? And the initial response by the Gibeonites is, well, you know, we don't care about money, and we don't have the authority to put anybody to death. So, by implication, there's nothing that we can do here. And David's response is, well, I do have the authority. What needs to be done to rectify the situation? And the Gibeonites' response is, we want 7 descendants of Saul. Give us 7 of Saul's descendants, and we will kill them. We will, and it's not clear exactly what the form of death was supposed to be. In my version, they've translated it hanged, but it's not clear that that was the form of death that would have been given. But they are going to put them to death. It says, before the Lord, in Gibeah of Saul. So by saying before the Lord, it's apparently a religious act that's going to be carried out. These 7 will be killed, and they will be done, and that will be done in Gibeah of Saul. Gibeah is the city from which Saul came, which suggests that in Saul's attempt to exterminate the Gibeonites, he probably killed them in their city, to add insult to injury. So that's what they ask. And David's response is, I'll do it. I'll do what you ask. Next section. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the oath of the Lord which was between them, between David and Saul's son Jonathan. So the king took the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, Armoni and Mephibosheth, whom she had borne to Saul, and the 5 sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she had borne to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Mehalathite. Then he gave them unto the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the mountain before the Lord, so that the 7 of them fell together. And they were put to death in the first days of harvest, at the beginning of barley harvest. So David is put in the difficult situation of having to figure out which of Saul's descendants he's going to turn over to be killed. His first consideration is, it won't be Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan. Because remember, David had made a covenant with Jonathan way back that David would look after the descendants of Jonathan forever. It was a covenant between Jonathan and his descendants and David and his descendants. So David has a commitment to Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth will not be a part of this deal. That's certain. So who is he going to pick? He takes two sons of Rizpah. Rizpah was a concubine of Saul. And the two sons are Armoni and Mephibosheth. So this has to be a different Mephibosheth. Let's notice here that there are family names that get used, get repeated. That's going to be significant in a little bit later. And five sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul. Some texts read here Michal, who, if you'll recall, was married to David. But it says elsewhere that she had no sons. And some texts have Merab. That seems to be the more likely reading. So this Merab then is the daughter of Saul. So these are five grandsons of Saul that are being added to the two sons of Saul. And those are the ones that are being turned over to the Gibeonites. It is likely that that these, at least the sons of Merab, are children. Because of the way that it designates who they are, the sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she had born to Adriel, it's quite likely that they are young, and that would make sense in the chronology. And they aren't named. That's the most significant clue, that they're probably young. So he may be giving over very young children to the Gibeonites to put to death. The Gibeonites take them then. They execute them before the Lord. So it's a ritual killing. And all of that takes place in the first days of harvest. And that, the beginning of the barley harvest, that would probably have been in March that that happens. The next section. And Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of harvest until it rained on them from the sky. And she allowed neither the birds of the sky to rest on them by day, nor the beasts of the field by night. When it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, the concubine of Saul, had done, then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the open square of Beth-shan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines struck down Saul and Gilboa. And he brought up the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from there, and they gathered the bones of those who had been hanged. And they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, in the country of Benjamin and Zelah, and the grave of Kish, his father. Thus they did all that the king commanded. And after that, God was moved by entreaty for the land. So the concubine of Saul, she decides that she is going to protect the bodies of these seven young males who were descendants of Saul. She's going to protect them from further disgrace. It was disgraceful for a body to be out in the exposed in the open and subject to desecration by birds and animals. So she wants to prevent that from happening. So she goes to the place where they are laid out on the hillside, and she spreads out sackcloth, and that's where she sets up her camp, and she makes sure that birds don't land on the corpses and that animals don't come and feed on the corpses. And she does this probably for a long time. It's not clear. She does it until the rains start. So the question is, when do the rains start? But typically, the rains would not start until about 5 months later. So if so, that's a long time for her to carry out this chore. David takes note of what she's doing and responds and decides, these people need a dignified burial. And so after a period of time then, he collects their bones, and takes them to bury them in the homeland of Saul's family. And in addition, he collects the bones of Saul and of Jonathan. And as you will recall, Saul and Jonathan were killed in the last battle that they fought with the Philistines. It was a big battle. And Saul and David and Jonathan were both killed in that battle. And then the Philistines hung the bones of Saul and Jonathan on the walls of a city nearby. Well, some kinsmen of Saul made a raid and stole the bodies of Saul and Jonathan and took them and gave them a proper burial in their city. So David is going there, Jabesh-Gilead, and getting the bones and moving them once again to their final resting place where Saul's family had originated from, and puts the bones of the five who were killed all together at that place in Zela. And at that point then, God was moved by entreaty for the land, and the famine ends. Before I go on, I want to talk a little bit about this. This is a curious, very curious little incident. First of all, it seems to me that it is so like God to be so obscure. When David comes to him and says, "What's this famine all about?" All God says is, "It's because of what Saul did." Not a hint as to what David should do in response to it. David has to go figure that out. What David figures out to do is he's going to go ask the Gibeonites what should be done. And their response is, he says, what should we do? What needs to be done here? And I've told you their first response, and then he comes back, "Well, I'll do whatever needs to be done." And they say, give us seven descendants of Saul. It seems to me that in all likelihood, that would have been a very difficult choice, a very difficult thing for David to do. And in retrospect, I'm sure he had to have asked himself, "Why'd I ask them what needed to be done? I mean, wasn't there another way that this could have been done? Did I have to go ask them and then have them give the answer that they gave?" Then secondly, David had to choose the seven. He could have chosen differently. And he had to pick and choose between the seven, but whatever seven he was choosing them to go to their death. He was essentially choosing who to execute. And also, he could have said, "God, I won't do this. This isn't right. We'll just do more famine." And I'm sure that all of that had to run through his mind. It's interesting. This section makes sense, I think, of the incident when David was fleeing Jerusalem because Absalom, his son, had usurped the throne. And as you will recall, David is leaving Jerusalem. And as he leaves Jerusalem, he passes a city where there's this man by the name of Shimei. And Shimei comes out and is cursing him, is walking along beside David and cursing him. And let's go back and look at what Shimei was saying to him, because that will make more sense now. Chapter 16. I will read 5 through 14, just to refresh our memories. When King David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out from there, a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came out cursing continually as he came. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were at his right hand and at his left. And thus Shimei said when he cursed, get out, you man of bloodshed, you worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. And behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head. But the king said, what have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who shall say, why have you done so? Then David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my son who came out from me seeks my life. How much more now this Benjamite? Let him alone, and let him curse, for the Lord has told him. Perhaps the Lord will look on my affliction and return good to me instead of this cursing this day. So David and his men went on the way, and Shimei went along the hillside parallel with him. And as he went, he cursed and cast stones and threw dust at him. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary, and he refreshed himself there. Now this event makes a lot more sense. Shimei is cursing David because David put seven sons of Saul, descendants of Saul, to death. From Shimei's perspective, who is from the tribe of the same tribe as Saul, from Shimei's perspective, what David did was done to consolidate his power on the throne. He was eliminating all the heirs to the throne so that David's grasp on power was stronger. So it was a power play that David had carried out. David, I think, can't help but second guess the decisions that he had made. Did I decide rightly? I could have done differently. Did I do what I should have done? And now, with Absalom having usurped the throne, David's got to be thinking, maybe this is because of what I've done. And when Shimei is going along beside him, cursing him, David's thinking, maybe I did wrong. Maybe this is all justified. So David was put in a position where he was forced, he has to act regally. He has to act in a way that keeps the interests of the nation in mind. We've seen this before, that's a difficult thing. Balancing the interests of the various people involved, and that includes the nation, the interests of the nation, the kingdom as a whole. But David had concluded that he had no choice. He had to turn over the seven people to the Gibeonites and allow them to put them to death. It was a nasty job that David had to do, but it had to be done. And interestingly, those looking on, many of them couldn't understand what David had done and why he had done it. It was very open to misunderstanding. And some did, like Shimei. Okay, next section. I'll read 15 through the end of the chapter. Now when the Philistines were at war again with Israel, David went down and his servants went with him. And as they fought against the Philistines, David became weary. Then Ishbibenob, who was among the descendants of the giant, the weight of whose spear was 300 shekels of bronze in weight, was girded with a new sword, and he intended to kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, helped him and struck the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, you shall not go out again with us to battle, that you may not extinguish the lamp of Israel. Now it came about after this that there was a war again with the Philistines at Gob, and Sibbecai the Hushathite struck down Soph, who was among the descendants of the giant. And there was war with the Philistines again at Gob, and Elhanan, the son of Jaar-Oregim, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And there was war at Gath again, where there was a man of great stature, who had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot, 24 in number. And he also had been born to the giant. And when he defied Israel, Jonathan the son of Shimei, David's brother, struck him down. These 4 were born to the giant in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. So here we have a little account that tells us about events in which the Israelites killed 4 giants who were among the Philistines. The first one The first one is Soph, who it just says was a descendant of the giant. And where this term giant, it could mean a whole clan. It doesn't have to be one person. The second one is kills Goliath the Gittite, and as you can imagine, the commentators often speculate that this is there's just confusion within the tradition as to whether David killed Goliath or whether this guy killed Goliath. But as we've already noticed, names were reused. And this could very well be another Goliath, another man by the name of Goliath, who is also a descendant of the giants, who was killed. Then we have another one who goes unnamed, who had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot. And I missed one somewhere. There's another one in there too. Oh, yes. I didn't go back far enough. In verse 16, Ish-Benadab was killed. And he had a huge spear, and it says was girded with a new, and my translation has sword. It's a new weapon of some sort. So he's not only big, he's high-tech. Okay, so it's just an account of the Israelites having killed 4 giants among the descendants, among the Philistines. Okay, now the Psalm of David that concludes the first half of this conclusion to the 2 Samuel. This psalm is for the most part repeated in Psalm 18. Psalm 18 is very similar. There's just a few minor differences. This is not a difficult psalm to understand, so I'm going to read through the whole thing without very much commentary. And then I'll make just a few comments, and then we'll open it up for questions. In Psalm 18, by the way, it says that this was written on the occasion of David escaping from Saul and his other enemies. And David spoke the words of this song to the Lord in the day that the Lord delivered him from the hand of all of his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And he said, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge, my Savior, thou dost save me from violence. I call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. For the waves of death encompassed me. The torrents of destruction overwhelmed me. The cords of Sheol surrounded me. The snares of death confronted me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord. Yes, I cried to my God, and from his temple he heard my voice, and my cry for help came into his ears. Then the earth shook and quaked. The foundations of heaven were trembling and were shaken, because he was angry. Smoke went up out of his nostrils, and fire from his mouth devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down, with thick darkness under his feet. And he rode on a cherub and flew, and he appeared on the wings of the wind. And he made darkness canopies around him, a mass of waters, thick clouds of the sky. From the brightness before him, coals of fire were kindled. The Lord thundered from heaven, and the Most High uttered his voice, and he sent out arrows and scattered them, lightning and routed them. Then the channels of the sea appeared. The foundations of the world were laid bare. By the rebuke of the Lord, at the blast of his breath, at the last of the breath of his nostrils, he sent from on high, he took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, for they were too strong for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He also brought me forth into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. The Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has recompensed me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not acted wickedly against my God. For all his ordinances were before me, and as for his statutes, I did not depart from them. I was also blameless towards him, and I kept myself from my iniquity. Therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness before his eyes. With the kind thou dost show thyself kind. With the blameless thou dost show thyself blameless. With the pure thou dost show thyself pure. And with the perverted thou dost show thyself astute. And thou dost save an afflicted people, but thine eyes are on the haughty, whom thou dost abase. For thou art my lamp, O Lord, and the Lord illumines my darkness. For by thee I can run upon a troop. By my God I can leap over a wall. As for God, his way is blameless. The word of the Lord is tested. He is a shield to all who take refuge in him. For who is God besides the Lord? And who is a rock besides our God? God is my strong fortress, and he sets the blameless in his way. He makes my feet like hinds' feet, and sets me on my high places. He trains my hands for battle, so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. Thou hast also given me the shield of salvation, and thy help makes me great. Thou dost enlarge my steps under me, and my feet have not slipped. I pursued my enemies and destroyed them, and I did not turn back until they were consumed. And I have devoured them and shattered them so that they did not rise, and they fell under my feet. For thou hast girded me with strength for battle. Thou hast subdued under me those who rose up against me. Thou hast also made my enemies turn their backs to me, and I destroyed those who hated me. They looked, but there was none to save, even to the Lord, but he did not answer them. Then I pulverized them as the dust of the earth. I crushed and stamped them as the mire of the streets. Thou hast also delivered me from the contentions of my people. Thou hast kept me as head of the nations. A people whom I have not known serve me. Foreigners pretend obedience to me. As soon as they hear, they obey me. Foreigners lose heart and come trembling out of their fortresses. The Lord lives, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be God, the rock of my salvation, the God who executes vengeance for me and brings down people under me, who also brings me out from my enemies. Thou dost even lift me up, those who rise up against me. I'm sorry. Thou dost even lift me above those who rise up against me. Thou dost rescue me from the violent man. Therefore I will give thanks to thee, O God, among the nations, and I will sing praise to thy name. He is a tower of deliverance to his king, and shows loving kindness to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever. I was going to make a few comments on this, but I think I'll leave my comments until next week because it'll all tie in with the case that I want to make with respect to what this section is doing at the end of 2 Samuel. So let's stop there, and I'll give you lots of time for questions.
So by way of a little footnote at the bottom of this Bible, I have that there is another section that talks about these, well, some of these people, mm-hmm. and it's in Chronicles 24 through 8. Mm-hmm. Could you walk through that and talk about, okay, why people are different or why they might be the same person? Or because it has the Goliath guy has a completely different name in that section.
Right. I would not do a good job of that at this point. Let me look at that and then come back because I don't remember all the details of that. Okay. Sorry.
Somewhere in the law, I think it says that sons should not be punished for the sins of the fathers and fathers not be punished for the sins of the sons.
Yes.
And it seems like that's happening with the descendants of Saul. So I guess that makes it hard to know what to make of this. I mean, it sounds wrong to us anyway, mm-hmm. but, you know, I'm willing to give that they did things differently then, but it seems like it's against the law.
Right.
And yet God stopped the famine after it was done.
Right.
It's confusing. Got any help there?
It is. I don't think I can help you. And that's this is just a bizarre passage as far as I'm concerned. There's a lot that's bizarre here. Why God is doing things the way he's doing them, I don't understand. It seems very strange. And I think that adds to David's difficulty in retrospect, having made the decision, was that the right thing to do? But the famine ends. But I think that is, I was, when we came to that passage with Shimei, it was striking to me, why does David feel guilty with respect to Shimei's charges? And yet earlier in 2 Samuel, there was no indication that he had done anything to destroy the house of Saul. In fact, all of the indications in 2 Samuel are that David went out of his way to protect the household of Saul. The guy who comes and reports the deaths of Saul and Jonathan, doesn't he say he's the one who actually put them to death? So David has him killed. Then when Saul's son, Ishbosheth, becomes king, assassinate Ishbosheth, they come and report that to David proudly, thinking that David's going to reward them, and David has them killed. So there is absolutely no evidence that David has been bloodthirsty with respect to the descendants of Saul. It's just the opposite. So why is it when David is accused by Shimei of being of having blood on his hands with respect to the house of Saul, why does David seem to feel like there may be something to what Shimei is saying? And all I can think is, that was a very difficult decision for David to make, and he's still not sure it was the right one. That's the best I can do.
It seems also in the Bible, people have this tendency to say things like, whatever you say, I will do for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think, what is that?
Yeah, I don't do that. I think that's a dangerous thing to say. I don't know. But I think what he's doing there, there are hints in the Old Testament, negotiations that you see in the Old Testament, that that the first thing that people say is always, "Oh, I don't want anything," and that just seems to be convention. That the first time around you just say, "Oh, I don't want anything," and then you say, "Oh," then the person who is making an offer has to come back and make it more serious. And I think that's what's happening here. But I think that David, what he's thinking is, God has told me that the reason for this famine is because of what Saul did. And David wants to make it right. And what he's making clear is, I will do whatever it takes to make this right. And then I think he's probably taken aback by what the Gibeonites say is necessary to make it right.
David, you said when you were talking about kill that it was the same word used in Joshua, and that I didn't quite catch your exact phrase, but something like the word has religious connotations.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that?
Well, it's related to the when the Israelites came into Canaan, God placed the cities of Canaan under the ban. And part of the ban is the killing of people, and that's the word that's used there. And so that word has religious connotations. It's associated with the ban. So it's not just slaughtering, it's not just murdering, but it is killing in accordance with God's commandment. Okay, thanks.